Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on fairy tales when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values. These two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing, and Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. This income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. This income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. The income tax requires that we sign contracts with these foreign and alien gods that we call government in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed, and we call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it covetousness and theft in violation of Exodus 20, verse 17. Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way in our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10. And that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how and to practice that better way of life. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. That number again is area code 417-273-4967. Now, our tax and status school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Hey, we got a little girl here at the law school, and her mama's a student here, and she's been working here for a couple, 3 months. Just cute as a little bug's ear. She's about 8 years old. She came in the other day, and she said she'd been down to her fairy house. And I said, fairy house? Fairy house? What fairy house are you talking about? She says, oh, I have a fairy house down in the woods. I said, you have a fairy house down in the woods? Well, what is this fairy house? And she said, that's where my little fairies come and visit me. You have a fairy house in the woods, I said, and fairies come and visit you? She said, yes, of course. Well, what do you do when you're down there at your fairy house and when the little fairies come and visit you? And she talked about how she plays with the fairies, and she brings cookies down to the fairies, and she has a picnic down there with the fairies at her fairy house. And you know, this little girl has a very vivid imagination, and as adults, we sit here and we smile and we say, isn't that sweet? And I got to ask the question, what in the hell is sweet about teaching a little child lies about fairies, Christmas, Easter, Santa Claus, and Easter bunnies? I guess I'm old-fashioned, but you know, when I was a kid, I didn't believe in fairies. I believed in Santa Claus until I couldn't figure out how a big fat guy like Santa Claus could get down a 6-inch chimney into our raging oil furnace. We didn't have a chimney, you know, like people in the East have chimneys, you know, with fireplaces. We didn't have that. We had an oil stove, and this oil stove was full of fire, and Santa Claus is going to come down the 6-inch chimney. Well, I knew that wasn't possible because I'd been down to Brizard's store, and I saw Santa Claus in there, and boy, he was a big guy. But we teach our children these fantasies. We watch television. We let our children watch Barney and Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and we say, oh, isn't that sweet? The reality of it is that we don't want to take the educational responsibility ourselves. We're busy doing what we do in life, and we have to have something to keep the children entertained out of our way, out of our hair, so that they're not a bother to us while we're going about our daily chores. And so we set them down in front of the television so that they can watch Barney. Now, I wouldn't say that Barney is altogether bad, but I wouldn't say that it has any good to it either. It's a fairy tale. You know, dinosaurs are something different than Barney, and there aren't big birds walking around like we see on Sesame Street. That's not reality. And so a whole generation of children now from the 1960s, a generation being 40 years in biblical reckoning, 40 years now we've been teaching our children these fairy tales, and now we have a whole generation of people that believe in adult fairy tales, unable to connect the dots, unable to make intelligent, rational decisions, unable to determine or to decipher the lies or the chaff from the wheat, the lies from the truth that we hear in our everyday news media. And I'm suggesting now that Brian Williams and Katie Couric, you know, probably know the truth about the stories that they're reporting, but assuming that they don't, and they too have been raised with Sesame Street and Barney and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and they can't tell the difference between truth and the reality and fiction and make-believe, like the little girl with the fairy house. Wouldn't it be more intelligent to teach this child about how to start a fire, how to burn things in a burn barrel, how to clean the barn, milk a cow, how to plant seeds in the garden, do something practical, something intelligent, something that creates and produces useful, productive, meaningful work, which is where reality is located, food, clothing, and shelter. Now, Americans, and I suspect you Canadians and Australians suffer along with us, have been living in a fairy tale land since the end of World War II. I mean, we have been living the good life. There's just no two ways about it. Nobody else in the world lives like we do. Nobody else has that kind or that standard of living, especially on such a mass scale. It's kind of like a Disneyland. It's kind of like a fairy tale land here in America. And I suspect that when this comes to an end, there's going to be some real shock, shock and awe, as our illustrious president puts it here in the United States. Let me take a look here at a couple of three items. How about the war on drugs? Remember, we started this war on drugs here about, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. Was it Nixon that started that, or Carter? Somebody back here years ago came along and said, you know, these drugs that these druggists and these drug lords and so on are feeding to our children over here are bad and are wicked and terrible, awful and evil, and we got to do something about that. We send our children to public schools. This is where your children learn about drugs in public school. This is where your children buy their drugs in public school from pushers that are in the public schools. You send your child to the public school to teach your child sex education because evidently you're incompetent and unable as a parent to teach your child about the reproductive processes that go on among people and among animals and so on. And so we turn this over to professionals that we believe in wholeheartedly, these professionals, who teach our children more fairy tales in the public school system and divorce them from the realities of life. Reality. For instance, we've got a national debt here in the United States. And this national debt grows. We got these two wars going on over in the Middle East. And these two wars are sapping our monetary system. And so we have a budget, and our budget includes something on the order of $2.5 to $3 trillion a year. We can't live within that $2.5 to $3 trillion a year. So our federal government borrows $0.5 trillion a year, or $300 billion or $200 billion. And this has been going on now, for around 50 years. I can't remember the 2 years, but I believe that between about 1950 in 2000, we had two balanced budgets, leaving out the lies of the Clinton administration. If we include the lies of the Clinton administration and give him 8 balanced budgets, we've had 10 balanced budgets out of 50 years. That's 20%. How in the hell does that lend itself to reality? You know, where does fiscal discipline and responsibility comes in? And now it has translated, now that our government, not just the federal, but our state and local governments, they can't manage their money either. They can't stay within their budget. And so we, the citizens of America, have gone on a buying binge. We've gone out and spent money that we didn't have on our credit cards and maxed out our loans on our houses. And we've got automobiles that we owe money on. We're making payments, paying usury and interest. Can't count, can't connect the dots. And now as a nation, we're bankrupt. Our federal government's bankrupt, our state governments are bankrupt, and you and I are bankrupt. Most Americans are upside down financially. Not all of us, but, you know, most. What caused that? It didn't happen in 1850 or 1880 or 1910. People back in those days weren't watching Barney and Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Something was different about the educational system or about the nation as a whole or about what we were doing or where we were going or what our goals and aspirations are. So the war on drugs over here. In Afghanistan, they tell us that they got all these heroin poppies growing out here, and it's the fault of the Taliban. See, the Taliban over here is making all this money off of these drug and poppy fields over here. Now, wait a minute. Hang on a second. Let me give you a report. The Taliban are a bunch of religious people over there. They're Muslims, and they're real fundamentalist religion people, you know. And so they took over after they had successfully defeated the Russians back in the 1980s. They threw the Russians out, or the Russians, they didn't really get thrown out. The Russians finally got a belly full of it and said, I guess time for us to leave, and they left. And this group called the Taliban took over. And the Taliban went out, and they're opposed to drugs. And they eradicated the heroin drug trade. They eradicated heroin production in Afghanistan. I don't know if you knew that or not, but now if you did, well, fine. If you didn't, well, there's the real facts of the matter. Now, the Taliban were real bad guys, and I'm going to give George Bush credit for this and say, okay, well, they were real bad guys. I don't know that they were any worse than Fidel Castro or any worse than the Chinese communists or any worse than Joe Stalin, but, you know, for some reason, they're bad guys. And so George Bush comes along, President Bush, and he says, listen, you know, these Afghanis over here, they're the reason for the trade towers and 9/11, and they attacked us over here, and so therefore we got to go over there and retaliate, and we did. So maybe this is a righteous war. Maybe we belong there. And so we go over there to Afghanistan, and we throw the Taliban out, and we install a new government, and everything's going along pretty fine, one thing and another. Now, the heroin production in Afghanistan has been going on for, if not hundreds of years, at least for 100 years. It's a great place for raising heroin poppies, and it has been the source of most of the heroin in the world, both legal and illegal, for more than 100 years. Whether that's good or bad or right or wrong is for you to decide, but it's been going on. Now, the illegal drug trade has been declared to be wicked, awful, terrible, and evil, and it needs to be stamped out. And the Taliban did just exactly that. All right. Now, the Americans come in there, and they took over about 2003. And from 2003 until as I speak today, these are the 5 years that the United States occupation has been there, and the heroin poppy growing has grown back to where it was prior to the Taliban taking over and has exceeded it. 2006 was a record crop of heroin poppies. 2007 beat the 2006 crop, and 2008, they're telling us now, is going to beat the 2007 crop with the American occupation. And yet the fiction, that is the fairy tale that we've been told is that we've got a war on drugs, and that our objective is to stamp out heroin, stamp out cocaine, stamp out the drug lord, stamp out marijuana. Huh? It looks like to me that a bunch of backward camel jockeys did a better job of stamping out heroin in Afghanistan than the Americans have done. Doesn't it? So if you've bought into this fairy tale that the war on drugs includes Afghanistan and the heroin trade over here, you've been watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. You're unable to connect the dots. Now, the other day I'm watching the news, and I believe it was Brian Williams, and they had a report from Afghanistan. They're talking about the poppies that are growing over there and about how it's out of control, and God, we're just over there fighting tooth and nail trying to destroy this poppy crop. We just don't know what to do next. We're just working hard on this war on drugs, and that these drugs are being used to finance the Taliban, and the Taliban are growing all these drugs over here. See, it's not us. It's not the Americans. It's the Taliban. Oh, for crying out loud, let's grow up and get real. These religious nuts over here are the guys that stamped out the heroin trade. Now, that isn't the reason we went to war in Afghanistan, at least that's why we're told that. I suspect that the real reason, or one of the real reasons for war in Afghanistan, is because the Taliban stamped out the drug trade. Union Oil Company wanted to build a pipeline across Afghanistan, and they said, go to hell. And we said, well, we've had enough of that, and so we phonied up this Twin Towers trick over here on 9/11, went over there to take Afghanistan so we could build our pipeline and reestablish the heroin trade. I think that's about 90% of the truth. May not be all of it, but there's a hell of a lot more to it than what we're being told. And this war on drugs over here is as phony as a $3 bill. I don't know what the numbers are. I guess I ought to look this up and find out. But I would suspect that if you took the amount of money that we're spending on this war on drugs and the number of people that we're locking up in prison every year, and most of the people that are in prison today are in there on drug charges, we have created a whole list or a bunch of crimes over here that weren't even crimes 50 years ago. Let's take marijuana, for instance. Let me show you here in the Bible, the creator of the universe. This is God. Now, this is the creator, the guy that wrote this book here. In Genesis 1, verses 28 and 29, he says, or verse 29, he says, and God said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. And every beast of the field, and every fowl of the air, and everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. Did you catch that word green? I've given you every green herb. Well, not every plant in the world is green, but most of them are. And the last time I looked, heroin, that is the heroin poppy, cocaine, that is the cocoa leaf, and marijuana, that is the marijuana plant, cannabis, are all green. Now, here's the creator of the universe, the guy that created these three plants. And he says, let me quote it again. He says, I have given you every green herb for meat, for food. It's an herb. It's a medicine. Now, I'm not sure that the way people use marijuana, cocaine, and heroin are correct. I'm not sitting here defending heroin addicts, you know, in some seedy boarding house in New York, you know, tying a strap around his arm, finding a vein, and then shooting up with heroin is the correct use for heroin. But it was created by God and given to us as an herb. Now, up until recent years, I say recent, up until the last 100 years or so, this heroin, these heroin poppies and cocaine, and in South America, you know, the natives down there chew those coca leaves every day, just like Americans chew Copenhagen snuff, you know. Well, those people down there, they chew those coca leaves, and they don't think anything about it necessarily. People in the Middle East have been smoking hashish, and they've been smoking, I guess that's a form of marijuana or something like it. And for some reason, this has been going on for a long time, and mankind's been here for 4,000 or 5,000 years with these plants, and it never was against the law. And we never had any war on drugs here in the United States. In 1880, we didn't have any great drug problem. We didn't have a drug problem until we outlawed it. Now, what happens when you outlaw something? What happens when you ration something? Well, it makes it popular. It makes it the forbidden fruit. Now we've got to go get it. You know, if people could live with heroin and marijuana back in 1880 or 1900 or 1910 when it was legal, what then is the need to criminalize it today? Well, because it's wicked and evil. It is. Evidently, God didn't think it was. Number one, he created them. And number two, he gave them to us and said that he's going to give it to you as an herb, every green herb. Evidently, God, the creator of the universe, thought you could probably handle it. Your government came along and said, oh, no, you people can't handle marijuana and poppies. Why, we've got to ban that. We've got to take that away from you. I'm just, here's a reporter saying, well, excuse me, you've got 2 million people locked up in prison here in the United States. Half of them, that's a million of them, are in there because of drug charges. Drug charges that aren't even crimes. God has not made it a crime for you to use heroin poppies, cocoa leaves, or marijuana. That's something that your government did. You elected these guys. You sent them off to Washington, these 545 people, remember? And they're making your policy for you. They've created this. Now, it costs $50 billion a year to lock these people up in jail here in the United States, $50 billion a year. Half of them are in there on drug charges. It costs you $25 billion a year to lock these people up for something that isn't even a crime. And then you go over here and you blame the Taliban for the poppy trade in Afghanistan, which they had eradicated. Oh, wait a minute. There's something that's not adding up over here. It looks like to me that the United States of America, the world's preeminent military power, the people who are opposed, remember, opposed to this poppy trade, this heroin trade over here. Under the American occupation, you've got record crops coming out of Afghanistan. Under the Taliban, you had zero coming out. Now, who were doing the better job on the drug trade? And did the Taliban government, did it ever have the kind of resources, helicopters, money, agents, and DEA, to control the drug trade? Or were they a bunch of camel jockeys running around in the desert over there? Huh? Come on, boys and girls, wouldn't you say it's time to wake up and smell the coffee? The United States of America is in the drug business. And this war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. It's a cover story, like the CIA puts out, a cover story for the real business at hand, which is the drug trade. Now, why don't we just come right out and say, hey, we're all for heroin and heroin growing, and that's why we went over and conquered the Afghanis so that we could get the drug trade back on track. Because that's where reality is located. When we separate Barney, Big Bird, and Mr. Rogers out, that's where the truth lies. Now, there's a little bit more in this thing called fairy tales. Do you remember the cover story, We Want to Protect the Family Farmer? It started with Franklin D. Roosevelt in the Depression years. And there's the Great Depression came down upon the people of America. And so we've got all these people that are unemployed, and the economy has collapsed, and President Hoover doesn't know what to do next. And Franklin Roosevelt comes along and says, hey, listen, big smiling face, all you got to fear is fear itself, follow me, and I'll lead you into the promised land. And so we did. We voted him in and followed Franklin D. Roosevelt. And he said, agriculture in America is in a terrible state of financial decline and collapse, and what we want to do is we want to instill programs, you know, like the soil bank and price supports, and the government got into the wheat business and the corn business, and the government got into the farming business is what they did. And so I don't know if that's right or wrong or good or bad, but that's what we did. And so we want to protect the family farmer. Now, in 1920, we had 44 million farmers. When Franklin Roosevelt came into office in 1933, we had 32 million farmers here in the United States, 32 million. Now, they had declined from 44 million to 32 million. So we lost 12 million farmers in that 10 or 12 years, and probably most of them between 1929 and 33. I don't know what the numbers were per year, but my guess is that farm foreclosures, when Roosevelt was taking office, you know, in the months between the election in November of 32 and March of 33, farm foreclosures were at the level of 20,000 a month for December, January, February, and March, 20,000 a month. So when Roosevelt came into office, first thing he did was he closed the banks, sucked in all the gold, made some big changes, put in some emergency programs, and maybe all that was necessary. Maybe it was all good. I'm not here to criticize it. I'm just here to report on what the fairy tales are. And so he came in and he said, we're here to protect the family farmer, and we're doing all of this, and we're taking taxpayer money, and we're running up a big national debt so that we can work our way out of this depression and to save the family farmer. Okay, now that's 1933. By 1950, the number of farm families, or the number of farmers left on the land, dropped from 32 million to 15 million. And this is under in the period of time of the New Deal and the Fair Deal. This is the 20 years of the Democrats. All right, now one of two things, we'd have to come to a conclusion here, and one of two things has occurred here. Number one, President Roosevelt and President Truman, the two of them together, failed in their mission to save the family farm. Or two, they were incompetent. Or three, the saving of the family farm was a cover story like a CIA operation, to tell us one thing when in reality the real goal is to destroy the family farmer and replace him with corporate agribusiness like ADM and Cargill. Now, the truth of the matter is that the latter is the answer to the riddle. The reality is, when we divorce it from the fairy tale of saving the American family farmer, the objective of big government, the objective of top-down administration, the objective of the communist regime of the New Deal, Fair Deal, Roosevelt and Truman, was to destroy the family farmer and replace it with corporate agribusiness, and they succeeded beyond their wildest expectations. Now, that's where the truth is, and the fairy tale is that Americans, and I think the American farmer has believed and hoped and prayed and voted over the last 50 or 75 years for those politicians that said, we are here to save the family farm. Now, as I speak today, we have 1.9 million farmers, and I don't think there's very many of them that are family farmers. Many of them are, but not a whole bunch. Most of them are involved in corporate agribusiness. They farm thousands and thousands of acres. They are, in reality, agricultural industrialists. We have industrialized our agriculture. There's a downside to that, but that's another story for another day. My point is, that's a fairy tale. The belief that your government in Washington, D.C., and I mean, they're doing this to this day. These congressmen and representatives, when they come out here on the stump and they're giving you your campaign speeches, when they're in the rural areas of Iowa and Nebraska and Missouri, they're telling us, we're here for the American family farmer. Well, we're just here to save the American family farmer. Hey, family farmer's in trouble, and if you elect me, I'll go back to Washington and I'll enact these bills and I'll put in this legislation. Listen, family farmer, your problem is with government. Your problem is with all of these bills and all these programs. They're the 545 guys in Washington, D.C. that have caused your problem. And one of two or three conclusions smacks us right in the face. Either one, they failed, therefore they're incompetent. Or two, they haven't failed and they're not incompetent. They have succeeded at their goal in destroying the American family farm, because that's the reality and that's what's happened. And the salvation of the family farmer is just a fairy tale like Barney, Big Bird, Sesame Street, and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And let me give you a reminder here, I'm find my paper again, that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in 112 countries daily, worldwide, over the internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well, georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or local radio station. And if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about fairy tales. I told you about the little girl with her fairy house down in the woods, and that's kind of cute. And we talked about the war on drugs and the Taliban. By the way, 90% of the world's heroin comes out of Afghanistan, 90%. Only 10% is produced in Southeast Asia, what's known as the Golden Triangle. And then we want to protect the family farm and the family farmer. That's just another fairy tale. It's a damn lie, as Mark Twain used to put it. He said, you know, there's liars, and then there's damn liars. And when your government says that we're here to protect the family farmer, well, next time you hear a politician come by and tell you that my campaign is based upon saving the family farm and the family farmer, he's not only a liar, he's a damn liar, because he knows better. That's his cover story. I mean, think about it in pragmatic terms. I mean, we're looking for votes. And if I come out here running for public office and I say, listen, I'm in the employ of the Rothschilds of Europe and the Rockefellers and the Central Bank of the United States. Our objective is to destroy the American family farm and replace it with corporate agribusiness. Vote for me. I'm the best candidate to accomplish that goal. I mean, you know, that's like voting for euthanasia for your grandmother. You can't get people to vote for that. So what they do, they come to you and they say, look, vote for me. I'm in favor of saving the family farm. Then he goes back to Washington, busily goes to work on the Rothschild-Rockefeller program, and enacts legislation which will benefit ADM and will be a detriment to and a roadblock to the American family farmer. And then they put this into operation, and of course the family farmer goes bankrupt, and ADM makes millions more. And then we sit there and say, well, vote for me, and I'll go back and we'll change that farm bill, and we'll do this, that, and another thing. Until hell, even the American farmers today, they go to their Grange meetings and they go to their farm groups, you know, and they're talking about, well, we need to go to Washington, get our government now to give us a better program than we had last year. The one last year failed us, and so hell, every farm program from Roosevelt to last night failed you, didn't it? I mean, if it didn't fail you, how come all of you farmers went bankrupt? The whole damn thing was a fiasco and a failure from day one from the point of view of the American family farmer. Has it ever occurred to you to tell the government to get the hell out? Now, let me tell you what. There's a group of farmers here in the United States of America. They're not organized. They don't belong to the Grange. They don't belong to any farm organizations. They don't get price supports. They're harassed and harried. Their product has been declared to be illegal and unlawful. If they get caught growing their crop, they will be jailed. Their crop will be confiscated. They don't farm thousands and thousands of acres. They don't buy John Deere tractors. They don't buy farm machinery and farm equipment. Most of them don't even own their land. They plant their crop out in the national forests and out in the deserts and out in the wayward places where it's hard to get to. They irrigate their crops by carrying water from creeks in 5-gallon buckets and watering their plants one at a time. You know who these people are? They're the American marijuana growers. The American marijuana growers. And they're growing a crop. It's called a black market crop. And they sell it on the black market. If they get caught growing their crop, they will be jailed. If they get caught selling their crop, they will be jailed. They get no price supports. They consume no taxpayers' dollars whatsoever. They rely totally on the free marketplace. And last year, they produced $37 billion worth of marijuana, which was a bigger cash crop than wheat, corn, soybeans, or cotton, the four biggest crops in the United States of America. Now, that tells you what could be and could be done in the United States of America, and I would submit in Australia, Canada, and every place else where there are family farmers. Because remember, all of these marijuana growers are just little family farmers. There's no big ADMs or Cargills or departments of agriculture involved in the growing of marijuana. It's all done by just thousands and thousands of little guys with 10, 15 plants. Maybe you might have a big marijuana grower who has 100 plants or something like that. Now, that's the power of the marketplace. That's the power of free enterprise. You wheat farmers out there, you kick the government out and go back to free enterprise and you'll start making money in wheat. You corn farmers, you kick the government out of your business and you'll start making money at corn. All right. So it's a fairy tale. The Department of Agriculture and the government coming here to save the family farmer is a fairy tale like Barney and Big Bird. It's time to wake up, children. Smell the coffee. Connect the dots. Now, George Bush, and I noticed the other day, Hillary Clinton, she outdid George Bush. Hillary was talking to a group of people, and she said what Americans want are jobs, 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 and more jobs. And that's four jobs in her campaign speech. George Bush, when he was running for office, last time I heard him was back in was 2004. And he said what Americans want is jobs, 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 just three jobs. Okay. And the first guy that came up with that was George Bush Sr. when he was running for re-election back in 1992. And he said what Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. Now, I don't know why you want a job. That isn't what God offered you. Your creator offered you land. Your creator offered you 33 benefits, rain in due season, land, great wealth, everything that your hand touches, everything that you set your hand to do will prosper. The creator of the universe never offered you a job. He never offered you the status of a bond servant. And that's what an employee is. You see, in ancient times, you know, going back, you know, to the 1850s and 40s and 30s, we had a status of people in Anglo-Saxon administration called bond servants. And when one of these people living in Ireland, let's say, wanted to come to the United States or Australia or Canada or someplace, wanted to get the hell out of Europe, he needed to have money. He needed to have a way that he could pay for his passage. And this guy is poor. Didn't have any money. That's why he wants to get the hell out of Ireland. There's a potato famine here. I need to get out of Dodge. So what he would do, he would bond himself to somebody here in the United States, and he'd do it through an agent. So he'd go down, sign up, kind of like going down to job service. You know, you're looking for a job, and so you go down to the job service or you go to an employment agency. And the guy in the employment agency, you know, he's got listings there because there are people that are looking for laborers. And so the guy would go down, he'd say, well, okay, I'd like to go to the United States or Canada or Australia. And he'd say, well, sign the contract right here, and we've got a blacksmith in Vermont, and he needs some help. and he'd like to hire you as a bond servant. And the terms of bond servitude were that you signed yourself on, this guy would teach you a trade. And so he'd hire you on as an apprentice, and then later you'd become a journeyman, and then later you'd become a master, and you could become a carpenter, or you could become a farrier, or, you know, you could become a something else. So you signed on, this is for 7 years. 7 years. So kind of like joining the army. And you gave this master, your master now, your labor for these 7 years, and he was going to teach you a trade. Now today we call those employees. We don't call you bond servants anymore. That's because it's politically incorrect. President Abraham Lincoln abolished the bond servant statute of the Bible. God evidently thought that it was a pretty good idea. Abe Lincoln and the Republicans back in the Civil War said, no, that's terrible. That's really a bad idea. Let's fix God's mistake. Let's change this bond servant thing. Let's create a 13th Amendment here. We're going to free all the slaves. Well, okay. Now that you've done it, it's done. Now we've abolished bond servitude. So now what we've done is we've created a whole class of people that are called employees. And they seem to be a pretty happy lot. I mean, they're working out here, you know, for General Motors and Lockheed Martin. And oftentimes they get paid good wages, and they like it. They like their wages. Now, in our society, we have another class of people that we call yuppies. And these people are not employees. And these people are entrepreneurs. And some of these entrepreneurs, you know, they'd go out and they'd do things, you know, like drill wildcat oil wells, and, you know, they'd become millionaires. And then there's a guy named Warren Buffett. There's another entrepreneur named Bill Gates. And these people make fabulous amounts of money. They're the masters. They're not the bond servants. And, of course, these people, they get elected and they go to Washington, one thing and another. And these people need steady labor forces. Henry Ford pioneered this. He created this Ford Motor Company, and he needed labor. He needed, you know, people to put the wheels on these cars so he could sell them. And so he initiated a program called the $5 day, $5 a day for a day's work. We're 12 hours a day, got paid $5. You're getting less than 50 cents an hour, but, you know, it made you feel real good. $5 a day back in 1913 was a lot of money. Most people were working for a dollar a day. Ford was paying you $5 a day. All right, so that lured you off the farm. That's what that did. It got you to leave the farm, come to the city where you could become a dependent. You could become a bond servant, and you could get paid real well, offered you security. That's what it did, offered you security. And so today, when we take a look at our industrial productivity in 1960, 63% of the American GDP, that's your gross domestic product, gross national product, used to call it the GNP, was done through this industrial process. It was you worked for Ford Motor Company, you worked for some lumber mill or something like that. Today it's down to 9%, and this is called outsourcing and offshoring and one thing and another. So from 1960 until today, now we're talking about nearly 50 years. In 50 years, we have destroyed our whole industrial base. The very purpose for you leaving the farm in the first place was so that you could tie on to this industrial base. You know, you wanted jobs, jobs, jobs. And so over the last, at least since George Bush the first, 1992, they've been advertising jobs, jobs, jobs. Vote for me, and I'll give you jobs, jobs, jobs. What we want are more jobs, jobs, jobs. Boys and girls, that's a fairy tale. Poppycock. You've had fewer and fewer jobs in the industrial sector since 1960. Furthermore, your wages have not gone up 1 cent in purchasing power since 1973. That was the high water mark for wages in the United States of America. And I suspect that somewhere around that time for you Australians and New Zealanders also. And your standard of living has gone down every year from that point on. That's why you've got half the women of your country working in the workforce. It takes the combined salaries and wages of both a man and his wife. And you, with the both of you working, cannot equal the standard of living that you had in 1958 when old dad was working by himself and mom was staying at home as a homemaker and educating the kids at home or doing whatever she was doing, whatever she was doing. So we've got this fairy tale running around here that the government is out here creating employment, that the government through, and they come out every week, at least once a month, but you know, I watch this on the news. Employment is up. Employment is down. The unemployment rate went up a tick of 0.1%. It went down a tick. We have full employment. Well, we only have 3.5% unemployment. We only have 6% unemployment. Almost every night on the news, there'll be some kind of unemployment statistic, some kind of an unemployment fact. You know, Bell Telephone laid off 30,000 workers when they merged with so-and-so over here. The government's been involved in jobs, jobs, jobs. And they come out, these politicians, they come out and they tell you, vote for me, and I'll go to Washington, and I'll create jobs, 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 which is what the American people want. First of all, I can't understand for life me why in the hell we'd want a damn job. Tell me, would you? Send me an email. Explain to me employment. Tell me why it is we want a damn job, why we want to be a bond servant, would you? I don't want to be a bond servant to anybody. I don't want to be your employee. I want to be your master, punk. And so here's your reality. The reality of it is that we've outsourced millions of jobs to China. Millions of jobs have been sent overseas to Bangladesh. We take our factories and we dismantle them. Take a look in Pittsburgh. The population of Pittsburgh back in 1960 was 1 million people. Today it's around 300,000. What happened to 700,000 people in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? Well, all of your steel mills closed down. You people in Pittsburgh, I forgot the exact number now, but it was around, 25 or 30 steel mills were operating in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1960. Today you got none. Zero. And your politicians have been telling you for the last 50 years, what? Vote for me, for jobs, jobs, jobs. And all your steel mills have been closed down, haven't they? They're gone. And you're sitting here, and you're going to vote for who? Have we taken total leave of our senses? What in the hell are you smoking? What are you listening to, Barney? Big Bird? Mr. Rogers? Have you lost your minds? Unable to think? Now you can sit there and say, well, it's not Hillary's fault, it's the damn Republicans. Excuse me. Wake up here, kids. This has been going on through Eisenhower and Nixon and Reagan and Bush and Bush. It doesn't make any difference whether you got Franklin D. Roosevelt in office or you got Ronald Reagan in office. You got the same loss of jobs, jobs, jobs from 1960 to 2008. And these guys are sitting at the helm of power in the White House and sitting at the helm of power. You know, did Newt Gingrich reverse it in 1994 with the Republican Revolution? You know, you sit here and you say, well, it's not that guy, it's this other guy over here. It's not Carter, it's Reagan. Well, it's not Reagan, it's Clinton. It's not the Democrats, it's the Republicans. It's not the Republicans, it's the Democrats. Hell, there's only two political parties here, kids. Only two. Nobody else has been in office in this country except Republicans and Democrats since the Civil War. Nobody else has ever held that office. In fact, I don't even think, except for about four or five independents, you know, who were Republicans and then they switched to independent, or they were Democrats and they went to independent. Except for a handful of independent mavericks. They're all Republicans and Democrats. So my common sense would say to me that if you wanted to make any change, you wouldn't vote for John McCain. You wouldn't vote for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. You'd vote for Mickey Mouse or Mr. Rogers or Barney or Big Bird or anybody, anything, Mickey Mouse, Bugs Bunny, for crying out loud, rather than vote for a damn politician. I mean, if you wanted real change. I think the only guy that makes any sense over here is a guy named Bob Chapman, who puts out the International Forecaster. He says, vote out all of the incumbents, Republicans, Democrats, whatever the hell they are, vote them out. Every incumbent, except Ron Paul. You know, Ron Paul is the only non-communist in the Congress of the United States. I don't know how in the hell you people down in Texas that vote for Ron Paul. How in the hell can you people vote in good conscience for a non-communist in the United States of America? Ron Paul, the other day, I heard a little excerpt from him. He was talking to some group over there. He said he wanted to abolish the IRS and replace gold and silver. He wanted to abolish the Federal Reserve. You know, that's what the Bible requires. Now, that's what God told you to do. Remember that in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36 and Deuteronomy 25 verses, I think it's 25 or 22, verses 13 through 16. I guess I'll look that up for you right here quickly now that I opened my big mouth and I told you it was Deuteronomy, son. Anyway, it says you're not to have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Deuteronomy 20, 25 verse 13. You shall not have in your bag diverse weights of great and small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures of great and small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Eternal your God gives you. If we use unjust weights and balances, our tenure in the land will be shortened. Won't it? That's the way I read that. Take a look at it for yourself. Or as they say down at the Blue Room, read them in a week, boys. Get your bets up. Well, anyway, these are what I call fictions. These are fairy tales, like the little girl going down in the woods to her fairy house. And we adults here in the United States, and I suspect you Australians have this problem also. I don't know whether you're watching Barney and Big Bird and Sesame Street, but you people down there in Australia have been smoking something. You people up in Canada got your heads up something other than reality. Otherwise, how come you people have the same problems we have here in the United States? How come you're out here fighting this war on drugs? How come you have criminalized an activity? I mean, it may be a bad activity. It's kind of like smoking cigarettes. I think smoking cigarettes is a bad thing to do. I used to smoke. I smoked Camel Studs for 9 years. I enjoyed every puff. I thought smoking was the greatest thing since sliced white bread, probably good for my health. And I'm sure the people, when they watched me smoke as a pimply-faced punk, must have said, God, that kid's done. I don't deny it. I wasn't very bright. Been to public school. They dumbed me down. I smoked Camel Studs for 9 years. But one day I woke up and I said, I don't think this is too good for me. I think I'll quit. And I did. Now, I never did smoke marijuana, do crack and cocaine. Of course, I don't do aspirin and Sudafed either. And I figured that drugs weren't very good for me, so I don't take drugs one way or the other. And I'm not advocating it. In fact, it's witchcraft is what it is. But this thing of getting your government out here to hire thousands of people on a war against drugs is preposterous poppycock. Locking a million people up in jail and charging yourself $25 billion a year when you're flat-ass broke and bankrupt doesn't make any sense. You know that? You know, you people remind me of a guy that's just been declared bankrupt, and he says what we need is a princess cruise. That's where Americans are today. You know, we're in denial. We're living in this fantasy world of television, fantasy world of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where everything is just touchy-feely good, kind of like Katie Couric, you know, just touchy-feely good. We're sitting here in the world today looking at 48 nations in the world out of 58 countries that have now imposed price controls, consumer subsidies, and export restrictions or lower tariffs on rice and other grains in their export market. And we're sitting here talking about touchy-feely good on Katie Couric, and the world is facing famine, and we're talking about fairy tales. It's going to come back and bite us in the butt, kids. It's time to wake up and smell the coffee and start connecting the dots. Well, that's fairy tales for today. We'll talk to you about that again next time. Keep in mind that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Here, time's about up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course, talking about fairy tales. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.